Historians can sum up an era biographers, a life. Jazz historians often attempt to do both, defining an era in terms of musical lives lived. Nothing, however, compares with the voice of someone who was present when history was being made and very much paying attention. Lorraine Gordon has lived more than a few lives. Downtown bohemian, uptown grand dame, record business pioneer, wife, lover, mother, and finally, at a point when most women her age are settling into grandmotherhood, owner of the most famous jazz club in the world, the Village Vanguard. But having said that, the thing that makes Lorraine Gordon most interesting is she's the owner of the world's most famous jazz club, but she can still flick a chicken. Welcome.
Thank you. What an intro.
Thank you for taking some time out.
I've been looking forward to seeing you. And can I mention the noise that you may be hearing that's distracting me? I don't know about you, but this building has been under scaffolding for, it seems to me, like a year. Horrible scaffolding. Everything is obliterated. Our sign, the awning, yet people find their way here. Nevertheless, it's a great day that you chose to come as they're banging and pulling it to pieces. So that's not me. That's the scaffolding coming down.
I thought for a minute it might be the spirits that are present here at the Village Vanguard. But what has brought us here today is the subject of your new book from Herman Leonard. It's called Alive at the Village Vanguard. And it is your story, or as much of it as you chose to tell, inside the two hard covers
here.
Very
funny.
And incidentally and coincidentally, just like WBGO, it starts for you in the world of jazz in Newark, New Jersey.
How odd that WBGO should be in Newark, New Jersey.
An arts high school attendee, you know, arts high school.
I went to arts high, are you kidding? I loved that school. I wish I had stayed there, because I really wanted to be an artist, and I just loved that school. I don't know why I transferred to Weequahic, but Philip Roth made it famous, but that's not why I went there.
Well, you're one of the famous ones from Arts High School, though. I mean, alongside Sarah and Wayne Shorter and Savion Glover, and this year they celebrate their 75th anniversary over there.
What, Weequahic?
No, at Arts High School.
Oh, Arts, yeah, because I still get literature from Weequahic. I'd like to get some from Arts High. I have pictures of me at Arts High with the president of the class and all that. Because I lived on High Street, down the other end, and Arts High was on the other end of High Street. But anyway, I went there because of art.
Read the excerpt from your new book that talks about the Hot Club of Newark.
So our headquarters was in the neighborhood house, a two-story place. It was like the local Y. My family lived then on High Street, right on the convergence between Black Newark and White Newark. The neighborhood house was over in the Black section. We would meet there. You could rent a room for perhaps a dollar a day, and everybody would have an assignment. You'd have to share what it was that you'd learned about jazz. I remember one of my assignments was Bessie Smith. I brought my records. Everybody sat around on the floor. We had a little record player, and I delivered the story of Bessie Smith, complete with recorded examples. I described how terrible Black life was in those days, how bad things were, the poverty that dominated the world of Black people, and I played backwater blues, and nobody knows you when you're down and out. Those songs, to me, were poetry, pure, pure poetry.
When it rained, 5 days in the sky turned dark at night. When it rained, 5 days in the sky turned dark at night. Then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night.
Also in Newark at the time was the Alcazar Club.
Well, we went there because a great artist was living in Newark that nobody knew, called Jabbo Smith. Well, we collected Jabbo Smith records that were made in 1925, 26 on Brunswick. Oh, the most incredible trumpet player. And he had been built up in the early years to compete with Louis Armstrong. That didn't happen, but he was nothing like Louis Armstrong. He was so radical and so different.
Speechless at that time. And while things were going on the Newark side of the Hudson River, on the New York side of the Hudson River, you had 52nd Street, didn't you?
Well, that was my reason for getting born in Newark, so I could hop the Penn Railroad and get to New York. But my parents didn't I had to wait. My parents didn't take me. Yeah, well, that was the fun part, to come to New York City where there's some action, which I really didn't have in Newark, New Jersey. But I was very naive. I was very young, you know, 16, 17, 18. So I got to New York through a friend. Well, no, I got through many different routes to New York. Some they weren't all friends.
Who were some of the people you saw on 52nd Street?
On 52nd Street?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I remember most is going to a club called Jimmy Ryan's. And it's kind of an intimacy that you'll never find again. Not on that street.
And also in one of those clubs was a man named Alfred Lion.
Oh, I forgot that. Yeah. What did he play? Well, yeah, inadvertently, he was sitting on the banquette across from me where I was looking at Joe Marsalis. It's a Marsalis. I can't remember. It's not related to Wynton at all, but I think it's Marsolis is the way this clarinet player spelled his name. Oh, yeah, so he was, Mr. Alfred Lion was over there because I was collecting his records for quite some time because I was listening to the radio where this disc jockey brought me here to hear the music. It's a complicated route. And I love the records. I said, whoever made these records is a genius. They are so brilliant. They're so different. They're so avant-garde. You know, there's a 12-inch record, a 10-inch record. The label was beautiful, chartreuse and blue, very modern. I could barely afford those records. I think the big one was $1.50. The little one was $1. But I did buy them. And I never knew that that was the man sitting there who made these recordings. So the friend who was with me took me over and introduced me, and that's how I met Alfred Lion of Blue Note Records, my first husband, just for a little while.
7 years.
Well, that's pretty good. Yeah, I learned a lot, and I had a great time. Boy, I saw the greatest musicians in the world that we recorded. Oh, it was fabulous.
You had Sidney Bechet, and who were some of those musicians? At that time, for those people that are familiar with the Blue Note record label, it was a little two-room office. And not only did you marry Alfred Lion, but you also worked at the record label and did just about everything, didn't you?
That's true. We had this office at Lexington and 60th, right across from Bloomingdale's, which was not the glamour place it is today, in the Lambert Brother building. Downstairs was a jeweler. It was a wonderful old clock out on the sidewalk, and we were up on the top floor in wonderful little offices that we felt so, you know, in business and wonderful, and the neighborhood was beautiful. I walk by sometime today. It doesn't make me feel I remember what used to be. It's not nice. It's not as good as. In any event, yes, we were there, and we sold the records from there. And Frank Wolf, who was Alfred's friend from Germany. They both, you know, as you left, they left that wonderful man who drove everybody out of the country. And they worked with the records. And I, of course, was they were so glad to have me. I could type. I could talk on the phone. I could fill orders. I could do bookkeeping. I could do a lot of things. And that's what I did for years, recording with Alfred, some of the great artists of that time, who are still very great anyway. You can buy their records today. I mean, there was besides Sidney Bechet. Oh, God, there was Sidney Catlett, that great drummer. There was Sidney DeParis. There was a whole list of incredible jazz musicians of that time. They weren't beboppers, but they were authentic jazz artists. And we can fill in with all the names later. It's a big roster. And that's what I did. We worked together and we built the company, not the way it had become, but Alfred continued without me, and he did very well, and I'm so grateful that he left his name and his label around the world.
January 6th, 1939, right after the Spirituals to Swing concert at Carnegie Hall in December of the previous year, so it was just a few weeks later, Alfred Lion was so moved by John Hammond's concert that he took two of the pianists from that evening, Mead Lux Lewis and Albert Ammons, and put them in the very first recording session for the Blue Note record label, and he never looked back.
But he was so ahead of his time then, because I remember he made two 12-inch sides with Mead Lux Lewis improvising. Now, 12-inch sides, two of them, that's four sides of improvisation, to me was the most radical thing I ever heard. I mean, bebop was nothing next to that for me. And then he did the Boogie Woogie. It was Pete Johnson, Albert Ammons, and Mead Lux Lewis, and I fell in love with them. To this day, I love that music. Alfred was a radical, definitely. He set the path for many other record companies to follow.
You know, as I look at you, you favor your mother.
My mother? When did you meet? Did you go out with my mother?
I did not go out with your mother, but you do favor your mother, and that, as you know, is a big compliment.
It is, because she was beautiful, but she knew nothing about music.
And it could have been worse. You could have favored Paul Whiteman.
Well, yeah, how'd you know that, you rascal? You look like him. Well, yeah.
Paul Whiteman and your mother dated briefly,
yes,
when she was in Denver.
In Denver, Colorado, because his father was the music superintendent of all the schools in Denver, and Paul was his son, a ne'er-do-well at the time. But my mother loved to dance, and Paul Whiteman liked my mother, and he took her dancing. And my mother's parents, I think the father, said, "He's no good, not for you, no more." So that was the end of Paul Whiteman.
Back to the Blue Note record label, yeah. and a connection once again that takes us back to Newark. is a saxophonist by the name of Ike Quebec, who came on board at the Blue Note record label, not only to record some of his first sides, but also as, I guess, an unofficial music director and making recommendations. Who were some of the people that he recommended that Alfred give a listen to and pay attention
to? Not some of the people. The person is what you should say.
The person.
Well, by the way, I never knew that Ike Quebec came from Newark when I was now living in New York. I mean, we all talked about that later. But the person, when Ike became more helpful to my husband Alfred with ideas, that Alfred really didn't know everybody. Ike was a fabulous musician. He's one of my favorite saxophonists. Tenor. I love tenor sax.
Thank you.
introduced us to Thelonious Monk. We heard the name, but we didn't know Thelonious Monk. Barely, you know, would know how to get to him. But he took us to his apartment, and that's where we landed with Alfred, me, Frank, Ike, and Thelonious.
Read the excerpt from the book about that day you auditioned Thelonious Monk.
It was Ike Quebec who first took us to see Thelonious Monk. Ike didn't say about Monk record him. He just said, come on, I want you to hear someone. Ike didn't take us to a club either. He took us to Monk's West 63rd Street apartment. And Alfred and I, well, we heard him. Monk's room was right off the kitchen. It was a room out of Vincent van Gogh somehow. You know, aesthetic. A bed, a cot really, against the wall, a window, and an upright piano. That was it. We all sat down on Monk's narrow bed, our legs straight out in front of us like children. I looked up. Monk had a picture of Billie Holiday taped to his ceiling. The door closed, and Monk played with his back to us. He had enormous hands. Those hands almost stammered, it seemed to me, right above the keys. Where are they going to come down? I kept wondering. It was just riveting to watch. Together because we fainted when we heard Thelonious. And to me, he was simply the most exotic, bluesy, wonderful pianist. I didn't think of bebop then. I was not on that bebop scene at all. As a matter of fact, it wasn't my thing. You know, it was somewhere else. But Monk was a transition for me because to me, I look at that left hand and watch him. He was like a great blues pianist with quirks, you know, a little different. So I was captivated by him, and we all were. And so, of course, the recordings were done on Blue Note, and I think they're beautiful. They're my favorite Monks. I still listen to them. And they went on to be, you know, the great Thelonious Monk, who nobody knew at that time. The public didn't know. Musicians knew, but that was about it.
And you helped the public understand the genius of Thelonious Monk because he was not as forthcoming as a lot of people were
right. In
communicative skills and such. But you were family. I mean, to the point where
right. You
drove him around and took him to interviews.
Yeah.
And you tell a humorous story in the book about setting up an interview.
Monk was a special person. If you met him and you didn't understand that, don't come back, you know. But we understood him. What's to understand? Everyone's not the same. He's a person who's interesting. He doesn't want to talk. He wants to play piano. Great. Anyway, I finally got so excited about Monk. I remember sitting at my little typewriter up there on 767 Lexington Avenue. And I liked him. There was a newspaper at that time called PM. I think it was PM. Ralph Ingersoll was the editor. It was, you know, a progressive newspaper, the kind I would like to read. And so I wrote this man a letter, the editor, and I just said, you know, there's a genius living in this town. And I think if someone should come and report on him and talk about him and blah, blah, blah. And I went on through my letter. And golly gee, I did get an answer back from Ralph Ingersoll saying, I liked your letter. I'm going to send a reporter, take him over to this man's house. Well, the date came, and I think it was Seymour Peck he sent, the reporter. I had to pick him up in my car, and I drove him to Monk's Hell's Kitchen apartment there in the West 60s. And he got out of the car, and I got out at my side, and he says, where are you going? I said, I'm going with you. He said, no, you're not. He said, no, you can't come with me. I do the interview. I said, well, you can't. He said, yes, I can. I said, goodbye. And he went down the hall. I sat in the car, and 5 minutes later, he was out there. There is no interview there. I said, shh, I told you. Anyway, he left me high and dry. So I went back to the office, and I called Ralph Ingersoll and said, I told the man he cannot interview Monk alone. He doesn't even want to talk to me if I don't hit him the right way. He said, we're going back. And so he sent him back with me. And what came out was a double-page spread of Monk with a picture of Billie Holiday on the ceiling over his bed and the kitchen with a big Frigidaire in the middle. And a fabulous story, the first big press thing that Monk ever got.
Did you realize at the time what you were in the middle of, or was it the energy of the music, or what was it that carried you?
It was such a combination of things. I mean, Monk himself is an incredible looking, unorthodox looking man who you don't expect. I don't know what to expect. It's when he sits at the piano that the whole aura of his originality comes across, the way he moves his body, the way his hands are splayed out over the keys. You know, I'm used to seeing piano players go up and down those keys a million times. I'm always impressed because I can't play an instrument, and piano is the one thing I want to play. But everything about him, his aura, was of an original person. Now, you have to have vibes to understand that. I had the vibes. I could dig that, and that was true.
We're talking with Lorraine Gordon. The book is called Alive at the Village Vanguard. It's from Hal Leonard. And caught up in a whirlwind of music and the music business, but at the same time, on a personal level, there was something pulling at you too, and that is the desire to have children.
Oh, isn't that what women like? I thought that was so ordinary. I did. I mean, actually, yeah. Why not, I thought. I've tried everything else. Now let's try children. Yeah, but, I mean, Alfred's baby was Blue Note Records. He had his baby. It was just very new. It was just walking, you know, it was tottering along. And it wasn't that we didn't have any bread. I mean, we lived very frugally. We did no fun, no movies, nothing, just the records. Anyway, that was the turning point when I decided I'm getting older. That's what women have to think about. And that's what I thought about.
You would never know it because that rift, I guess, that came up between the two of you drove you to Mexico for a while, where your brother was and some other people, and you did some modeling for a while.
Oh,
and there is a photograph in this book of you modeling. And I'm you were a fox. That's the only way I can say it. Unbelievable. Just
modeling. Listen, I was in San Miguel de Allende, which was a big artist colony at the time. And my brother was a GI, and his wife, they just got married, Gertrude, they were living there on the GI Bill of Rights. And in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico, the great Mexican artist David Alfaro Siqueiros was there teaching. Wow, that's one of the great artists of the world. So that's where my brother went. He's an artist. And I went because I was in betwixt men, shall we say. But it was an art school, and I was young and whatever, and they would ask me to model, but I was too modest. So you see me with clothing on because I refused to model in the nude. I was too modest. I was still a very naive person. So that's the most you'll get out of me modeling was that in Mexico.
But before you left for Mexico, you came into contact with Max Gordon.
Who? What'd you say?
What was that name again? It's ringing a bell.
That rings a bell.
Quite a bell, I would imagine.
First of all, let me tell you something. After I finish this ice cube, you see that bar here? I stood at this bar with my little guys and gals. One other woman and me from Newark Hot Club would come here on a Sunday afternoon. Was a jam session up there that Harry Lim would run. I mean, I'd hear Lester Young, Roy Eldridge. The greatest jazz in the world took place up there. And we stood back here at the bar. We had maybe enough for a couple of beers. We're probably too young to drink, but there were no laws then. Passed it around. A man was standing at the bar. And I think he got annoyed with us because we're such enthusiasts. You know, we're probably clapping. And he said, get rid of those kids. I vowed revenge. That's how I, the first time I ever saw Max Gordon. I mean, I was 18 or 19.
Well, and you, and later you would approach him when you were married to Alfred,
yes,
about booking Thelonious Monk.
Absolutely. And now I'm years later in the Fire Island, a place that Max and I eventually built a house, but that's going ahead of. And I saw Max Gordon sitting at a little cafe with coffee and a bun in the morning. I happened to be there. I came in. I saw the man. I knew what he looked like. I'd never met him. But I went up to him and I said, Mr. Gordon, I'd like to tell you about a very fine jazz pianist. I know. He looked me up and down. He said, yeah, sit down. Have a cup of coffee. Which I did. And then I proceeded to do my thing on Thelonious. Well, he said, yeah, I'm interested. I just happened to have a week in September, first week. Great, I said. So Max and I shook hands. We got a deal. And that's it. I left. I went home to Alfred and said, can you imagine we got Thelonious into the Village Vanguard? Which wasn't, you know, it was okay, but it wasn't Radio City Music Hall. But I was very proud of this. Well, sure enough, the week came. And Thelonious sat up there at the piano, and Alfred and I sat over on that right banquette, and nobody was here. A very slim audience. And I will say, there was not one reviewer of these great reviewers who went out of their minds when Thelonious played at the Five Spot, and suddenly they had a revelation. They didn't even come here. They didn't even know who he was. So I'm resentful about that. Nevertheless, Thelonious did his thing, and Max anguished because when Thelonious got up to announce a number or something, he would say, and now human beings are going to play and go forth and do a little dance and then sit down. So Max said to me later, what kind of an announcement is that? I said, Mr. Gordon, you don't understand this man. He's a genius. He said, are you trying to ruin my business? I said, you'll learn. Goodbye, whatever. That's how I met Max Gordon, who wanted to learn, obviously.
And that relationship, obviously.
He wanted to learn.
He wanted to learn, and learn he did. The two of you were married, and you entered into a world of both downtown, the Village Vanguard, and the world of uptown. With the Blue Angel.
Oh, very chic, very glamorous, and very exciting for me, you know. Yeah, that was Max's club. He had it with a partner up there, and it was a beautiful area up in the East 50s, and all the very chic nightclubs were there. And Max would interview a lot of people down here or put them on and bring them uptown. There was a kind of an escalator system going here.
The Blue Angel was certainly ahead of its time musically and socially. You write about it in the new book. Share it with us now.
Well, perhaps the most important thing about the Blue Angel in retrospect was the utter absence of racism on or off its little stage. The Blue Angel audiences were always mixed audiences. New York nightlife at this time, particularly in the upper echelons, was still shockingly segregated. Max and Herbert were both unapologetically colorblind. In fact, it was probably the one quality that they shared. It was Max, though, who brought in most of the Blue Angels' black performers. My head is full of names, all the greats who became stars there, black and white. Harry Belafonte, Nichols and May, Barbara Streisand, Eartha Kitt, Carol Burnett. I used to sit with the performers every night between shows at our corner banquette, just inside the door as you walked in. Some I gradually got to know better than others, like Bobby Short. He was my dear friend to the end of his life. Bobby played piano and sang in the lounge at the Blue Angel. Nobody knew Bobby Short then. He was just that guy at the piano near the bar.
I'm one of your admirers. I'm with you all the way. You may have a few faults, you drop ashes, but that smile when it flashes, it's what I wait for every day. I'm one of your admirers. I'll always see you through. You may act indifferent to mislead me, but I know that you need me almost as much as I need you. Whenever you want me.
And I had a great nightlife from between the Vanguard and the Blue Angel. And there were other clubs we had. We had an old-fashioned ice cream parlor. Well, there's a lot. I have to write another book.
In the book, you describe quite accurately the musical legends who played the Village Vanguard. Can you share part of that book with us now?
The litany of jazz names Max brought in during this period established the Vanguard's peerless jazz identity for all time. Carmen McRae, Charles Mingus, Thelonious Monk, Stan Getz, Ben Webster, Mose Allison, Anita O'Day, Teddy Wilson, Miles Davis, Horace Silver, Chris Connor, Dizzy Gillespie, George Shearing, Johnny Griffin, Lambert Hendrickson-Ross, Zoot Sims, Max Roach, Red Garland, Amma Jamal, Dinah Washington. Max booked Aretha Franklin as early as 1960, Ornette Coleman and Nina Simone on the same bill in 1961, Roy Eldridge and Lenny Bruce on the same bill also in 1961. For over a month, Carol Sloan, who still appears at the Vanguard regularly, debuted in August 1961, opening for Oscar Peterson, then sang opposite Lenny Bruce for a month in 1962. Carol tells the story of Lenny asking her to go back into the little dressing room Max had then for the performers, just to the right of the stage, to get Lenny's socks. I left my socks hanging there, he told her. So Carol went in and got Lenny's socks, thinking, these socks of his are very heavy. Of course, they were filled with Lenny's stash of God knows what.
The 60s, a very turbulent time that a lot of us lived through. Some of us don't remember all of it, but we lived through it. For Lorraine Gordon, you went to the absolute extreme in that you protested, you recruited the likes of an unknown Barbara Streisand to protest what was going on and the turbulence of war and its repercussions, something that we probably could have used you a couple of years ago. But to the extent that you actually found your way to Hanoi.
One-way ticket. No, I have a return ticket. Well, I don't think that's going to an extreme, frankly. I think everybody should be doing that with what was going on in the world then. It's not much better today. I could do it all over again. It's like the same terrible story. But then, if you have children gave you a sensibility that maybe if you were a bachelor or a woman, you didn't think about those things. But when you think about nuclear testing and what it does in the atmosphere and the strontium 90 and the cesium 131 and the cows eat the grass and your children drink the milk and all the poisons that are coming out of nuclear testing from the Soviet Union, from the United States, who were the big mockers, you know, when it came to killing, they knew more than anyone. So, yeah, I went out there. I was outraged. What is going on? If you don't read a newspaper, don't you read a book? Don't you understand what life is about? You want your children to grow up and your grandchildren to have a world. And we see nuclear bombs. Hey, all the great men in the world that are against this. I'm not talking about presidents. I'm talking about Einstein and, you know, great thinkers. How they get involved in this nuclear race? Well, people got involved like myself because we had to learn what's going on here. What kind of a world is this? And so I learned about it. And yes, I walked around with posters and banners, and I traveled the world. And then came the war in Vietnam. I said, what kind of craziness is this? What is the what are we doing in Vietnam? Is there oil there? What's going on here? I don't really know the fine details, but I'm not against the women in Vietnam. They are my friends and my sisters. And I'm against the war, the most terrible war ever. And people like, Nixon, Johnson, Kissinger.
Henry Kissinger came.
I should have thrown the door, slammed it in his face. He's a war criminal. Well, he had a very important man sitting up in front of him, who at that time was the president of, what's the country? You know, my brain's getting a little twisted now. Yeah, Vaclav Havel, who's an important writer, an important man. I didn't know he invited Kissinger. And he was sitting, and when the man came to the door and said, my name is Harley Kissinger, I said, that'll be $20 admission, $10 minimum for drinks. And he put out his hand to shake mine. I put my hand behind my back, and I turned my back on him. Hey, that was just impromptu. I hadn't known he was coming. I didn't want to make a scene here after all. I have to be rational sometimes. Made my point. That was it.
We're sitting in the Village Vanguard, probably at one of the most quiet times that I've ever experienced here. It's in the afternoon. We're talking with Lorraine Gordon. And you look around the walls of this club and you see photographs, but at the same time, you feel the spirit, and it's a very powerful one in this room, because when you see John Coltrane and Dizzy Gillespie and Miles Davis and Sarah Vaughan and the hundreds of photographs that adorn the walls here, these people stood on that stage and performed. Do you have any highlights, I guess? If you had a highlight reel, and that's a horrible question to ask.
Oh,
I hate that question.
Highlights of what? A person performing? Oh, I have a wonderful highlight. Of a great, great artist, 6'2" or thereby, big man, who came to play here from Cuba. And it wasn't easy for him to get into this room, although every artist in the world, if we want them, can play here. This man was deflected from the United States government, from the FBI, from the president, or whoever runs this wonderful idea of not allowing artists to come to this country because they got some beef about Cuba, who's a little island out there that doesn't have oil. Anyway, I hired him.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Village Vanguard.
Chucho Valdez. Wasn't easy, but I got to him. We became friends, and he did come here, and this place was filled with people waiting for his opening night. It was advertised everywhere, and then I get a call from the State Department. Well, he's being delayed at the this or the that or this paper or that. I said, that's okay. We're going to wait for him. We're here. He got everything cleared before I did this. I went through a lot of stuff. Anyway, we waited, but anyway, it was getting late. And finally, the doors opened, and down the stairs came Chucho Valdez with his arms filled with flowers, and the people just stood up and applauded, and he walked up to the piano, and he played like a trill, a couple of notes, and he turned around and said, I'm very tired. Come back tomorrow night, which they did. I never forget that, because this man has been prevented from playing here or any other place because he's a great pianist or because he's a Cuban. I don't understand it. Yes, I do, but I fight against that. Every night here is marvelous for me. in a sense, because it's my reward. Because I work here all day, and that's, you know, a lot of work. It's not always wonderful. It's hard, and it's good, and it, you do your stuff. But when you come at night, oh, it's your reward for all the things you do in the day to make the club operate.
You have been the proprietor since 1989 with Max's passing. Mm-hmm. How do you determine who gets booked at the Village Vanguard?
Ah, that is the mystery. I determine who I like, who I want, who I can communicate with musically. I don't have to be my friend. You don't have to talk to me all day. I like what I want to hear. And I also like to see the club filled with people so I can pay the rent. So it's, you know, it's a lot of different strands that go together. And I don't do anything I don't like, even though it could be the biggest thing in the world. I don't care.
As you come to the close of the 70th anniversary, in February it'll be the 70th.
71.
Yeah.
We're going to 72.
We're going to 72. And you look out there, what do you see that you would like to do at the Village Vanguard that you haven't done yet?
I'd like to have a palm tree up there and some sand and a beautiful hot sun and call it Honolulu for a week. I don't know. A vacation is what I need. No, I can't think of anything I want to do except find some people I don't know who may be wonderful that I could say, wow, it's worth a try.
What an animated life you find between the covers of your new book, Alive at the Village Vanguard. If you will, your thoughts from the book about your life's fortune.
I started as a kid listening to jazz records. I followed the jazz thread throughout my growing up years until I married Alfred Lion of Blue Note Records, who was practically nobody then. Come on, we were both nobodies, and we worked together for 7 years, recording, hanging out with musicians, hanging out at Birdland on Broadway. My life for 7 years was nothing but music, morning, noon, and night. 7 years of that, unrelenting, which led me to Max Gordon. And more years, many, many more years of music and nightlife, nightclubs. I guess I was just meant for this. I must have been. It takes a lot of stamina, and then to have 2 children and to raise those kids. At least I hope I raise them. They grow no matter what you do. What I'm saying is, I didn't arrive at the Village Vanguard from out of the blue. I stuck to what I loved. That was my art. I'm not a musician. I'm not a singer. I'm not a painter. I'm not an actress. I'm none of those things. But throughout my life, I followed the course of the music that I loved. I was not a musicologist, nor was I a theoretician. I loved jazz, and what I loved was terrific. I'm very proud of what I loved, and that is what allowed me to take on the Vanguard and carry on what was started here and is certainly not finished here. I'm forever thinking, my goodness, if I didn't have this, what would I do? There are benches in the park across 6th Avenue where I see these nice little old women sitting every day, and there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Live at the Village Vanguard, My Life in and Out of Jazz Time, is a new book by Lorraine Gordon. As told to Barry Singer, it's from Hal Leonard. I'm Gary Walker. What a pleasure it was to speak with Lorraine Gordon and share it with you today on WBGO Newark. Music your way. Straight ahead.